Hello and welcome to the Vanity Fair Hour on Sun Sounds of Arizona. My name is Amy Smith. I'm your volunteer broadcaster for this program. Today we're reading from vanityfair.com. We've got, celebrity news, Hollywood news, lots of politics. But first, we had two celebrity deaths this week to report on. The first is Gene Hackman. This first article, Gene Hackman and wife Betsy Arakawa's deaths deemed suspicious in search warrant. No obvious sign of a gas leak. This is by Chris Murphy, published on February 22nd. The deaths of Oscar-winning actor Gene Hackman and his wife, classical pianist Betsy Arakawa, have been deemed suspicious, according to a search warrant affidavit released Thursday morning. The 95-year-old screen icon, his 65-year-old wife, and one of their dogs were all found dead Wednesday at their home in Santa Fe, New Mexico. Initially, the Santa Fe Sheriff's Office released a statement saying it did not suspect foul play in their deaths, though a cause of death had yet to be determined. Now, Variety reports that New Mexico authorities has deemed the circumstances suspicious enough in nature to require a thorough search and investigation. According to the excerpts from the affidavit published by Variety, when the authorities arrived at Hackman's property, the front door of the residence was unsecured and opened. The deputies observed a healthy dog running loose on the property, another healthy dog near the deceased female, a deceased dog laying 10 to 15 feet from the deceased female in a closet of the bathroom, the heater being moved, the pill bottle being opened and pills scattered next to the female, the male decedent being located in a separate room of the residence, and no obvious signs of a gas leak, the affidavit continued. Arakawa's body, the affidavit reads, showed obvious signs of death, body decomposition, bloating in her face, and mummification in both hands and feet. Hackman's body was reportedly found in the mudroom and also showed obvious signs of death, similar and consistent with the female decedent. The deputy on the scene suspected the male individual had suddenly fallen prior to his death. An estimated time of death has not been released for either Hackman or Arakawa. Per Variety, the authorities may search the property as well as the furniture, walls, plumbing equipment, and gas lines in or around the property. Affiant is aware, through training and experience, individuals exposed to gas leaks or poisonous gas can suffer immediate and unexpected death, reads the affidavit. Hackman's daughter, Elizabeth Jean Hackman, reportedly told TMZ that the family currently believes that carbon monoxide poisoning may have played a role in the deaths of her father and his wife. A legendary actor, Hackman won two Oscars over the course of his career, Best Actor for The French Connection in 1971, and Best Supporting Actor for Unforgiven, 1992. He married Arakawa in 1991 and officially retired from acting in 2004. Since Hackman's retirement, the couple had been living full-time in their Santa Fe home, reportedly built in 2000. And this is a developing story. Our next memorial, Michelle Trachtenberg, star of Gossip Girl and Buffy, dies at 39. This is by Savannah Walsh on February 26th. Michelle Trachtenberg, the actress best known for her roles in beloved 90s and aughts projects like Buffy the Vampire Slayer, Gossip Girl, Ice Princess, and Harriet the Spy, died Wednesday, a spokesperson for the NYPD confirms to Vanity Fair. She was 39. The spokesperson tells Vanity Fair that police responded to a 911 call at around 8 a.m. at 1 Columbus Place, a 51-story luxury apartment building on Central Park South. Upon arrival, authorities observed a 39-year-old female unconscious and unresponsive. EMS responded to the location and pronounced the victim deceased. Criminality is not suspected. The medical examiner will determine the cause of death, and the investigation remains ongoing. According to the New York Post's sources, Trachtenberg recently underwent a liver transplant. Vanity Fair has reached out to a rep for Trachtenberg as well as the NYPD for comment. Born in New York City on October 11, 1985, Trachtenberg got her start at age 9 on the 1990s Nickelodeon series The Adventure of Pete and Pete, before securing the titular role in 1996 Harriet the Spy alongside Rosie O'Donnell, and playing Dawn Summers, younger sister of Sarah Michelle Gellar's Buffy on Buffy the Vampire Slayer. Throughout the 2000s, Trachtenberg made a name for herself in adolescent-aimed films opposite bona fide movie stars. She worked opposite Matt Damon in 2004's Eurotrip, Joan Cusack in 2005's Ice Princess, and Zac Efron in 2009's 17 Again. She earned a Teen Choice Award nomination for her performance as the maniacal villain Georgina Sparks on Gossip Girl, which ran for 6 seasons. Trachtenberg's final on-screen role was a reprisal of Georgina for 2 episodes of the short-lived Gossip Girl reboot on Max. In the final year of her life, Trachtenberg's social media presence raised concerns among those concerned for her health after an apparent change in physical appearance. "I've received several comments recently about my appearance," she wrote in an Instagram post in January 2024. "I have never had plastic surgery. I am happy and healthy. Check yourself, haters." Our next article, the Fyre Festival is coming back and you can get a $1.1 million ticket. Sounds fun, right? This is by Casey Wickman on February 24th. Fyre Festival founder Billy McFarland is back with Fyre 2, a sequel to the disastrously scammy 2017 music festival that landed him in prison for 6 years for fraud. He served 4, released early for good behavior, after federal prosecutors labeled him the consummate con artist. So yes, let's do it again. Tickets, which are on sale as of Monday, February 24th, range in price from $1,400 to $1.1 million. And as a redirect page that shows up when you search for tickets reassuringly insists, Fyre Festival 2 is real. Real, just like Fyre original recipe partner Ja Rule. Ja Rule has not been publicly named as a collaborator this time around. During an interview with Today, which aired Monday, McFarland insisted that Fyre 2 really isn't about the past and isn't about me. It's about taking the vision, which is strong. So who's going to be there? Unclear. McFarland sidestepped questions about whether any artists have actually been booked for the event. He pointedly stated that he isn't in charge of booking and that he hopes the talent will be A-list. Not only does McFarland apparently not know what talent will be there, he doesn't even know if the terms of his release from prison will allow him to travel internationally to Isla Mujeres, Mexico, where the event is slated to take place from May 30th to June 2nd. In 2023, NPR reported that the terms of McFarland's release from prison had him under supervised release for 3 years, with regular check-ins with a probation officer and permission required if he wanted to travel beyond southern New York. From March 2022, however, those 3 years would be up approximately now-ish. There's hope for McFarland to light the fire yet, despite his worry in the interview that he'd be sadly watching from home via live stream. "It's not just music," he said of his plan for a hand-wavy luxury experience, where he promised the buyers of the $1.1 million Pommet House Pass would stay on a private luxury yacht and get up close and personal with that unnamed talent. "We might have a professional skateboarder do a demonstration. We might have an MMA champion teach you techniques in the morning." Though there are more than a few red flags, even beyond McFarland's undeniably terrible track record, eating dry cheese sandwiches and sleeping in a FEMA pop-up tent does not sound like a luxury experience, as original Firefest attendees would attest. He talked a big game. "We are selling the experience of Fyre," McFarland insisted. "I want to be one of the first festivals that can sell out with no artists. Want. It's good to want. It's important to dream." Though he acknowledged that there is a risk component to it for ticket buyers, this time around McFarland is partnered with a production company and a ticketing company for Fyre 2, Electric Boogaloo. "It's 2,000 people taking the risk, seeking the adventure, and wanting to be there for the moment," he said of prospective attendees. In a 2022 interview with Vanity Fair, McFarland said that he was totally above board with future ventures. He was pitching an app allowing access to celebrity experiences at the time. "I know that I'm going to try really hard and do it just the right way," he said. "If I lie to anybody again, I go to jail for a very, very long time." In Monday's interview, McFarland said that he hasn't seen either of the two documentaries that have been released about the Great Fire flop, and he still owes $26 million in restitution for Fire Festival. 10% of the profits from Fire 2 will go toward that, with a minimum of $500,000. "My dream is finally becoming a reality," McFarland told Today. In a statement released on his X Monday, McFarland celebrated the opening of ticket sales, telling hopeful attendees to expect boundary-pushing excursions by day and intimate beachside performances by night. The festival takes place over 4 calendar days, but is billed in that statement as a 3-day escape to the Mexican Caribbean. As for what the 4th day will be, that's anyone's guess. Next up in the Hollywood section, Baby to Baby came to the aid of LA families within hours of the fires. This is by John Ross on February 28th. When the Los Angeles County fires erupted on January 7th, engulfing neighborhoods and displacing families, Baby to Baby didn't hesitate. Within hours, the organization mobilized its vast network of resources, volunteers, and corporate partners to provide essential relief to families who had just lost everything. "We're used to responding to disasters," says co-CEO Kelly Sawyer Potrikoff. "So when this happened in our hometown, where our headquarters are, where a majority of our staff lives, we were ready to go. This is what we do and have done for the past 10 years. The nonprofit swiftly delivered critical items, diapers, formula, clothing, and other necessities to families in need. Since Potrikoff and co-CEO Nora Weinstein joined the charity in 2011, the organization has grown tremendously. Their work has attracted an impressive roster of celebrity supporters, including Jessica Alba, Jennifer Garner, and Kim Kardashian, all of whom rallied to support the organization's fire disaster relief efforts. This year, Vanity Fair has chosen to support Baby to Baby alongside other local charities as part of its Oscar Week festivities, a testament to the organization's influence and impact. For Angelino families reeling from the devastation of the fires, Baby to Baby's immediate presence on the ground provided not just essential items, but a sense of stability and amid chaos. The charity's expansive network of 470 partner organizations that include schools, resource centers, evacuation centers, and state agencies enables its agility during crises. "Our phone is ringing off the hook," Weinstein says, describing the influx of support from corporate partners like Huggies and Skechers, who reached out immediately as the fires spread. "We have worked for a decade fostering these relationships and these corporate partners so they understand the ins and outs of our needs on an ongoing basis. They know Baby to Baby is going to find the right home for their diapers or toothpaste or clothes, and that we're going to get them to these kids." With the fires tearing through the heart of the entertainment community, celebrities didn't just offer their names, they offered their hands. The organization's Culver City headquarters became a hub of activity as Vanessa Bryant, Nicole Richie, Miranda Kerr, Ciara, Russell Wilson, and Hilary Duff arrived to pack boxes and organize supplies. The support extended beyond volunteer hours. Emma Greed, founding partner of Skims, joined Kardashian to donate 10,000 clothing items. Garners, once upon a farm, contributed thousands of baby and toddler snacks. "These aren't just names on a piece of paper," Potrikoff says. "They actually show up and do the work." While Baby to Baby has operated a disaster relief program for nearly a decade, responding to hurricanes, floods, and wildfires across the country, the Palisades and Eaton fires struck with painful proximity. Nearly everyone at the organization was affected personally or knew someone who had lost their home. "We have one member of our team who's a dad of 3 boys who lost his home in the Eaton fire," Weinstein says. "He showed up at work the next day. He wanted to get back to work and be here helping the team." Both CEOs describe a poignant phenomenon they witnessed repeatedly during volunteer sessions. Alongside those who came to help were those who had just lost everything. Even more striking was what they observed among families receiving aid: a reluctance to take too much, concerned there might be others in greater need. "Our team is there to reassure them that everyone deserves help at this moment," Weinstein explains. "We're there for all of them, and it's not going to take away from anyone else." The immediate crisis hasn't diverted Baby to Baby from its broader mission to make family care more affordable nationwide. The organization has already secured significant policy victories, including the removal of sales tax from diapers in California, previously classified as luxury items. We've been able to remove the sales tax from diapers in California, and many states have followed suit since, Patrikoff says. That is something that we're still working towards. There are 25 states left that still tax diapers. This legislative success represents just one facet of Baby to Baby's comprehensive approach, which also includes developing maternal health programs for new mothers. After more than 10 years of building Baby to Baby, Patrikoff and Weinstein have developed an ethos that serves them well in crisis response. "I am not afraid to ask for anything, and I'm not afraid to hear the word no," Patrikoff says. That determination is translated into immediate, effective assistance for a community in crisis, turning Baby to Baby into a lifeline for Los Angeles families recovering from this natural disaster. Next up in the Hollywood section, a review. Kate Hudson unleashes her star power on Netflix's Running Point. This is by Richard Lawson on February 27th. As we continue to fret about the state of the American movie star, wondering where we let all the mojo go, one such figure is quietly making her way back into the spotlight, albeit through television. We all remember Kate Hudson, the Hollywood scion who rocketed to fame 25 years ago in Almost Famous, for which she was expected to win an Oscar but lost in an upset. Had she won, Hollywood history may have changed forever. Eventually, she receded from the spotlight, seemingly of her own volition. She had businesses to run, children to raise. The roller coaster of professional acting probably seemed less and less worth the risk. Though Hudson never fully went away, her acting work slowed. But in recent years, Hudson has been popping up more frequently, suggesting she's perhaps ready for a full-time return. Exhibit A, her headlining role in a glossy new Netflix series, Running Point, starting on February 27th. Hudson is firmly the lead here, playing the once daffy party girl scion of a pro basketball dynasty who finds herself running the team after a family scandal. Coming from creators Mindy Kaling, Ike Barinholtz, and David Stassen, Running Point is mostly light and frothy, but it nonetheless gives Hudson juicier screen time than she's had in years. It's a pleasure to spend so much time with her. As newly appointed and newly ambitious LA Waves CEO Isla Gordon, doubted by her male siblings but constantly surprising them with her crafty competence, Hudson is effervescent, reminding us yet again of her nimble comic prowess. The patter on Running Point is very Mindy Kaling, fast and referential, and Hudson maneuvers it with easy wit. It's a joy to watch her quip and scheme. Hudson is a generous company woman, grooving on the show's ensemble energy and letting her scene partners shine, but she also allows moments for the camera to capture her singular star glow. Gushy as all that may sound, it really is refreshing to see a performance so assured and winsome in this particular way. A smooth, almost old-fashioned professionalism that never shows an ounce of sweat. Running Point is resourceful in its use of Hudson's charms, giving her a close-to-home role. Hudson, daughter of Goldie Hawn and Kurt Russell, knows a thing or two about trying to prove yourself in a highly profile family business, and then letting her flail and screwball around so nicely on nicely designed sets. Grit can come later, should Hudson decide to stick around in the acting world. To Running Point's credit, we don't spend every minute that Hudson is off-screen wishing she'd come back. Drew Tarver, of The Older Two, is a sly hoot as Isla's uptight gay brother Sandy, while Scott MacArthur, late of The Mick, gives good shaggy dope as slovenly but sweet brother Ness. The sibling dynamic is credible enough for an airy and glancing sitcom like this, while each actor stitches their own distinct comic sensibility into the show's gossamer fabric. Also surprisingly winning is Chet Hanks, himself a Nepo baby trying to make good as a vain and ridiculous star player on the team whose boorishness is regularly tempered by an oafish decency. Who knew that guy of all guys could be so strangely likable? Running point is generally easy to follow, following an engaging narrative pattern familiar to anyone who has seen Entourage. Comparing any contemporary series to that creaky relic may seem like a backhanded compliment at best, but Running Point successfully follows that old show's episodic rhythm. A potential setback leads to a clever resolution, which then leads to an unintended negative consequence that must be resolved in the next episode. Both series unfold against the backdrop of wealth and cultural power, which raises some of the stakes while comfortingly lowering others. What does any of this really matter when, in the worst-case scenario, all these people wind up out of a job but still very rich? There are romantic entanglements on Running Point, chiefly Isla's dawning attraction to handsome Waves coach Jay, played by Jay Ellis. Despite her almost suspiciously doting husband, played by Max Greenfeld, waiting at home. Sandy, meanwhile, has a secret boyfriend whom he does not want to expose to his noxious family. It's a plot that is maybe a little too similar to the ones Tarver was served on the other two, but it's endearing nonetheless. Tarver is adept at playing manic uptightness and frustration. What counts for intrigue on Running Point involves the clan's oldest brother, a secret drug addict who is flamed out but is conspiring to win back the throne. He is played by Justin Theroux, who brings the only flex of anything like darkness or danger to the series. Otherwise, Running Point merrily glides along on sturdy rails, its tart jokes delivered in bright staccato. The show's affability could prove too cloying were it not for Hudson's flintiness. Sure, she walks into glass walls and does other silly stuff, but it's still Kate Hudson we're talking about here, our casually cool Penny Lane. It's a breezy delight to watch her. May she never leave us again. This next article is from the Oscars section. Is The Substance a stealthily perfect trans allegory? Forget Amelia Perez, the Demi Moore body horror fable is a reasonable approximation of coming out as an adult, then discovering there's a hungry teenager living in your brain. This is by Emily St. James on February 26th. Somewhere around the midpoint of The Substance, a familiar series of emotions begins to build up in my general vicinity. As I watched the film, I could sense a sudden, immense feeling of self-loathing, riddled with disassociation and detachment. I recognized it as a dysphoria spiral, a complete and total realization of how badly one's mind and body have become disconnected. I'd been hit with those spirals for much of my life, up until I began to transition in my late 30s. It's not as though I ever experienced dysphoria anymore, but for several years it hasn't been as bad as it once was. So whatever was happening in The Substance, I was simultaneously familiar and alien because I wasn't feeling it. Instead, I was observing it, a sort of sympathetic resonance for the movie itself. Somehow, director Coralie Farragut had taken some of my worst ever experiences, mutated them so they could work as a body horror, and put them up on screen. It was a little like having an out-of-body experience, one that prompted a question I hadn't considered before sitting with The Substance. Is this movie the transest thing I've seen? Netflix's Amelia Perez, the most nominated film at this year's Oscars, should be the transest thing I've ever seen. It's about a drug kingpin who transitions to live as an anonymous rich woman with the help of an ambitious lawyer. Very much the sort of story cis people like to tell about trans people. Indeed, writer-director Jacques Audiard is cis. Though the film's star, Carla Sofia Gascon, is now better known for writing so many racist tweets, she's also the first openly trans woman ever to be nominated for the Best Actress Prize. So that's something. But while Emilia is ostensibly trans-forward, it's frustratingly bound by a lack of imagination when it comes to gender and transition. It is, for instance, all but impossible to refer to Emilia with she/her pronouns both before and after her transition, because the idea that pre-transition Emilia was violent and post-transition Emilia is saintly is central to the film's conceit. Emilia Perez functionally treats them as two separate characters, only knitting them together when, say, Emilia gets angry and her voice drops an octave. See, the movie suggests, she was really a guy all along. In some ways, this limited understanding of gender should perhaps bother cis people more than trans people. After all, it's not as though a woman has never been violent. Like Amelia, the substance is extremely French. Derogatory, in the case of Amelia, complimentary for the substance. Farget's film follows Elizabeth Sparkle, played by Demi Moore, an aging star drawn to her drug potion called the substance. Once she uses it, a much younger woman pops out of her back, Sue, played by Margaret Qualley. The rules are simple. Elizabeth gets 1 week, Sue gets the next week. At least some of the grousing about the substance has centered on how exactly the substance itself is supposed to work. Elizabeth and Sue are different people, but they're also sharing both an apartment and an entire life cycle. Anytime Sue overstays her time in their shared life, Elizabeth pays the price with her own aging body. First, she gets a withered finger, and more dramatic changes follow. As Sue starts wanting more and more time in their shared life, leaving Elizabeth to rot. So, are the two of them the same? Or are they one, as the voice on the phone, who represents the interests of the organization behind the substance, frequently reminds them? The film's curative subject is how young women, who are valued by society, and older women, who are not, are artificially pitted against each other. The perceived beauty and fuckability of younger women give them advantages that even a 60-something woman as beautiful as Moore simply cannot access. And yet the curse is that aging comes for us all. Even if Sue and Elizabeth stick to the rules of the substance as written, Sue will eventually still age into someone who won't be valued by the world. By stealing opportunity and years from Elizabeth, Sue is ultimately only stealing from herself. It's a body horror stab at female solidarity. Elizabeth and Sue are two different people, but the struggle they face is the same one, even if they can't always see it that way. And yet, allow me to venture to a queer trans reading, one that posits Sue and Elizabeth are actually both different and the same person. When I started transitioning, a younger woman I had put on ice in my brain suddenly woke up and started pestering me. She hadn't gotten to experience the joy of childhood, the boundary pushing of adolescence, or the fucking around and finding out of one's 20s. She wanted those years back, but she was stuck with me, her weird adult self who had spent all of those years doing her level best to offend precisely no one. It's not as though I injected myself with a drug and had a younger, hotter version of me to spit out my back, but hormone replacement therapy does tend to make women, both trans and cis, look younger than their age, if only subtly. And the more I estrogenated myself, the more that girl in my brain was like, when do I get to take the wheel? Is this queer trans reading of the substance? Elizabeth is someone who has come out late in life and mourns the years she should have gotten as her best, truest self. The part of her that wants those years back is real and persistent and constantly yelling at her to get out of the goddamn apartment and have some fun already, but she can only listen to a point. Ultimately, her body is the age it is, and she'll inevitably be dragged back by the reality of that. I'm going to pause here to remind you that you're listening to the Vanity Fair Hour on Sun Sounds of Arizona, and my name is Amy Smith, your volunteer broadcaster for this program. We are in the middle of a review of The Substance, a film with Demi Moore. The Substance's presentation of something like transition that isn't precisely transition is much more metaphorically compelling and rich than Amelia Perez's very safe, soft gloss on an extremely cis person's understanding of it as a one-way trip between man and woman, with no way stations in between. I think I was supposed to see myself in Amelia, and there were elements of her story that felt recognizable to me, if underdeveloped, namely her struggles to accept and atone for sins she committed pre-transition. The Substance was far from my favorite movie last year. It's as subtle as an extreme close-up of Qualley's butt to the face, but watching it at least made me feel like I was seeing some version of my life on screen. Trans people have often found themselves in body horror, and as previously said, did you get it? As The Substance could be, it was no exception to the rule for me. What's more, I think it's a vision of the younger, hungrier entity inside someone who just keeps getting older is applicable to everyone on the planet. We all carry within us some memory of the person we used to be, whose back didn't ache when they got out of bed in the morning, whose legs didn't groan quite so badly after going for a run, or whose brain could think just a little bit more quickly. That person is somewhere inside all of us, and they desperately want to be calling the shots. Yet, here we are, trapped inside our bodies, trying to honor both the people we were and the people we're becoming. The substance understands transition so well because it understands that with time, everybody transitions into another version of themselves, whether they want to or not. Move into the politics section now. Our first headline, Trump signs executive order making English the official language of the United States. This is by Katie Hirschenroder on March 2nd. President Donald Trump signed an executive order on Saturday designating English as the official language of the United States, a move that does not require federal programs to change their existing policies, but does allow government-funded entities to roll back language accessibility standards. It is in America's best interest, the order reads, for the federal government to designate one, and only one, official language. The new directive rescinds a Bill Clinton-era mandate requiring all agencies and federal funding recipients to provide language assistance to people who don't speak English. It does not, however, necessitate places to get rid of current policies or remove documents that list information in other languages. The New York Times reports, the pronouncement was the biggest victory yet for the country's English-only movement, which has long been tied to efforts to restrict bilingual education and immigration to the United States. Over 30 states, from California to Kansas, have already designated English as their official language. In 2019, according to a Census Bureau report, 67.8 million people in the United States, or around 1 in 5, spoke a language other than English at home, a number that has nearly tripled since 1980. Spanish or Spanish Creole are the second most used languages in the country after English, with around 42 million people using one of them at home. Lawmakers in Washington have long tried to pass legislation that would establish English as the official language of the United States. The most recent of those efforts was a 2023 bill called the English Language Unity Act. It was introduced by two Republican senators, Kevin Cramer of North Dakota and current Vice President J.D. Vance, then the senator from Ohio. Immigration rights groups say the move could impact how non-English speakers become U.S. citizens, vote, and access crucial federal services like healthcare. This executive order, while framed as promoting unity, risks dismantling critical supports like ESL programs and multilingual resources that help immigrants adapt and contribute, George Carrillo, co-founder and CEO of the Hispanic Construction Council, said. Imagine families navigating healthcare or legal systems without materials in a language they understand. It's a barrier, not a bridge. Some immigrants seeking citizenship are currently allowed to do the citizenship test and interview in their native language, as outlined by the Department of Homeland Security. The exclusionary nature of this policy will only fuel xenophobia and discrimination. At a time when anti-Asian hate and hate against other minority and immigrant groups are rising. APIA Vote, a nonpartisan nonprofit focused on registering Asian, American, and Pacific Islander voters, said in a statement, it will make it harder for them to participate civically and vote, as well as access critical health care, economic, and education resources. Vanessa Cardenas, executive director of America's Voice, an advocacy group for immigration reform, told AP News that this move by Trump isn't just an offensive gesture that sticks a thumb in the eye of millions of U.S. citizens who speak other languages. But, she continued, it will directly harm those who have previously relied on language assistance for vital information. Others critiqued what the executive order would mean for Puerto Rico, where 94% of residents speak Spanish. The president's order declaring English as the only official language of the United States reflects a vision of American identity that conflicts with our Puerto Rican identity, Pablo José Hernández Rivera, a non-voting member of the House and the resident commissioner of the U.S. territory, said. There will be no statehood without assimilation, and Puerto Ricans will never surrender our identity. The executive order comes after Trump focused much of his campaign strategy on scapegoating immigrants for a myriad of economic and social concerns. On the trail, he blamed murders in the U.S. on immigrants with bad genes, called immigrants living in America without documentation animals and not human. He also claimed there was a massive invasion at our southern border that has spread misery, crime, poverty, disease, and destruction to communities all across our land. Heading into the last election, xenophobia and hate speech were spiking, according to Yonatan Lupu, an associate professor of political science at George Washington University, who leads a team that monitors about 1,000 hate communities across a range of online platforms. Lupu told The Times that hate speech levels were up about 50% compared with early 2020, before the murder of George Floyd that summer. I certainly don't remember in my lifetime the rhetoric against immigrants ever getting this strong during an election, he said. Since taking office, the Trump administration has, among other actions, paused the resettlement of tens of thousands of refugees who were already approved to come to the U.S., authorized immigration officials to target courthouses, schools, and churches as a part of mass deportation campaign, and took down the Spanish language version of the official White House website, something he also did when he was in office the first time. When Trump was running for president almost a decade ago, in 2015, the Washington Post reported that he criticized his then-rival Jeb Bush to his face during a debate for speaking Spanish on the campaign trail. We have a country where to assimilate, you have to speak English. And I think that where he was, the way it came out didn't sound right to me. We have to have assimilation to have a country. We have to have assimilation, Trump said at the time. This is a country where we speak English, not Spanish. Our next headline, Trump and Vance's Oval Office clash with Zelensky devolves into diplomacy debacle. This is by Katie Hirschenroder on March 1st. From the moment Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky walked toward President Donald Trump outside of the White House on Friday, the mood was tense. After a brief, "How are you?" Trump immediately commented on what Zelensky, who was donning black pants and a matching military shirt, was wearing. "Oh, you're all dressed up," Trump said sarcastically as the two leaders shook hands. Whatever cordialness the pair had previously maintained quickly devolved over the next couple of hours in an Oval Office meeting that further strained relations between Trump and Vice President J.D. Vance and Zelensky into further disarray. The government heads, along with some foreign policy staffers and reporters, were meeting to discuss a new agreement on rare earth minerals. Upstairs in the East Room, the White House staff had set up a long wooden table for the leaders to sign, but they never got there. The beginning of the end happened when, around 40 minutes into the conversation, Vance, who hadn't spoken much until then, began to defend his boss's handling of Russia's ongoing war in Ukraine. "The path to peace and the path to prosperity is maybe engaging in diplomacy," the vice president said toward Zelensky. In a frustrated response, Zelensky outlined the ceasefires Russia had broken in the past, going back a decade. "What kind of diplomacy, JD, are you speaking about?" he asked. "I'm talking about the kind of diplomacy that's going to end the destruction of your country," Vance said back, sitting on a sofa with Trump to his right in a chair. "I think it's disrespectful to you for you to come into the Oval Office to try to litigate this in front of the American media," he continued, one of the multiple times he gestured to the reporters in the room. The group of pool reporters in the Oval Office was handpicked by Trump administration, their latest move in restricting which media outlets have close access to the president. "You should be thanking the president," Vance said. The vice president and Zelensky continued their back and forth before Trump interjected, leading to an increasingly loud and overlapping of voices in the Oval Office as people reportedly watched on in disbelief. You don't have the cards right now. With us, you start having cards, Trump said, chastising the Ukrainian president for not being more thankful to the United States and him personally for sending aid. I'm not playing cards, Zelensky responded. I'm a president in war. Vance then went in again, also accusing Zelensky of not being thankful enough. Please, you think if you will speak very loudly about the war, Zelensky began before Trump cut him off, saying he's not speaking loudly. What came next sounded more like one of Trump's rallies on the campaign trail and less like a meeting to mitigate any future harm in a war that's already killed or wounded roughly 1 million Russians and Ukrainians. At one point, a journalist asked what would happen if Russian President Vladimir Putin broke a ceasefire deal agreed upon by Russia, Ukraine, and the United States. What, if anything, what if a bomb drops on your head right now? Trump responded. In another moment, Trump began rambling about a Hunter Biden, Joe Biden, Hillary Clinton, Adam Schiff witch hunt and scam against himself and Putin as Zelensky listened on, visibly confused and furrowing his brow. In addition to reprimanding Zelensky for not being thankful or nice enough, the president also claimed he wasn't a tough guy, a charge that uniquely highlighted Friday's show of masculinity by Trump and Vance. The problem is, Trump began, I've empowered you to be a rough guy, and I don't think you'd be a tough guy without the United States. And your people are very brave, he said. Zelensky agreed to that part, but, Trump continued, you're either going to make a deal or we're out. And if we're out, you'll fight it out. I don't think it's going to be pretty. The meeting on Friday comes after Trump previously called Zelensky a dictator, and the Ukrainian president claimed that Trump is living in a Russian disinformation bubble. When Trump was asked later about referring to Zelensky as a dictator, he said, "Did I say that? I can't believe I said that." After the men eventually left the conversation with no agreement signed and relations tenser than before, Trump unilaterally decided that Zelensky was not in a place to negotiate, according to a White House official, and directed Secretary of State Marco Rubio and National Security Advisor Mike Waltz to deliver a message to the Ukrainians in the White House. It was time for Zelensky to leave. In the hours following, leaders from across Europe defended Zelensky, with French President Emmanuel Macron distinguishing between who he called the aggressor, Russia, and the victim, Ukraine. Many Republican leaders, meanwhile, rallied behind Trump. Senator Lindsey Graham of South Carolina, who had been one of the most vocal Republicans in support of Ukraine and who posed for a picture with Zelensky and fellow Congress members before the Oval Office meeting, quickly changed his tune, telling reporters later on Friday, "I've never been more proud of the president. I was very proud of J.D. Vance for standing up for our country." Later on Friday, Zelensky spoke with Fox News' Bret Baier, thanking Trump, Congress, and the American people for aiding Ukraine's efforts against Russia. "You helped us a lot. From the very beginning, during 3 years of full-scale invasion, you helped us to survive," he said. "We are thankful and sorry for this," Zelensky continued, mentioning this meeting. "I mean this, we wanted very much to have strong relations." He stopped short, though, of saying sorry directly to Trump when Baier asked him if he owed Trump an apology. When Baier asked if Zelensky believed that his relationship with Trump could be salvaged, the Ukrainian leader responded, "Yes, of course." According to CNN, Trump watched the interview on his presidential aircraft. Our next headline, Colorado Congresswoman totes newborn son to Capitol to vote against GOP budget plan. This is by Casey Wickman on February 26th. Babies' early months are full of milestones. First smiles, first solid foods, first congressional budget vote. Four-week-old Sam, the newborn son of Colorado Democratic Representative Brittany Patterson, is well ahead of his peers on that last one. Patterson, the old elder, is currently on maternity leave from congressional duties, but after being denied the option of voting remotely or having a proxy vote on her behalf, she packed up baby Sam and headed to D.C. to vote against the Republicans' proposal, budget, Tuesday night. "I wasn't going to sit back and not vote for anything where I could potentially be the difference," Patterson told the Colorado Public Radio. The Republicans eked out a victory with the budget blueprint passing 217 to 215, but Patterson, who appeared on the House floor with her baby in her arms, said she didn't regret making the difficult trip to make her voice heard on behalf of her constituents. "I knew this was going to be very close," she said. "I'm very disappointed that we didn't ultimately kill it, but our power is in the numbers that we have in the House for Democrats." She said that congressional colleagues met her at the airport to help with luggage and had been lending a hand, making sure mother and baby were fed and had everything they needed during their brief stay in D.C. "Nothing's easy when you're traveling with a newborn, and doing it alone was challenging," she said. "Then just being here, because he sleeps 1 or 2 hours here and there, so I'm exhausted." Patterson is part of a bipartisan group sponsoring a bill that would allow new parents to vote remotely while on parental leave. It has not yet come to vote. On X, formerly Twitter, Wednesday, Patterson wrote, alongside a clip of her speaking against the proposed budget plan on the floor, sleeping baby in tow, that, quote, "I have a message for Donald Trump. Nobody fights harder than a mom." Next up, this woman, who is not Elon Musk, is definitely 100% for sure running Doge, hand to God. This is by Casey Wickman on February 26th. Will the real Doge boss please stand up? A new player has entered the game with the White House on Tuesday, identifying a federal worker named Amy Gleason as the acting administrator of the government's cost-cutting task force, not Elon Musk, is thus far very public face. Gleason, according to her LinkedIn profile, served in the U.S. Digital Service Group during the first Donald Trump administration, focusing on the government's COVID-19 response and on issues relating to digital healthcare records. The USDS has been rebranded the Department of Government Efficiency, shrouded in mystery, mired with lawsuits from all sides, and still carrying its dumbass joke name. As the lawsuits continue to rack up, questioning DOGE's constitutionality, effectiveness, and leadership, while thousands of federal employees lost their jobs and nearly 24 DOGE employees quit theirs in protest, it remains unclear who actually served as the agency's administrator. The intrigue mounted on Tuesday morning when White House Press Secretary Caroline Leavitt declined to identify an acting administrator. Later that afternoon, the White House said it was Gleason, who is evidently currently on vacation in Mexico and reportedly had not been informed of her imminent unmasking. Meanwhile, in a House Oversight Committee Tuesday, Representative Marjorie Taylor Greene went off on federal employees, saying that they don't work real jobs and do not deserve their paychecks. In response to the confusion and anger over Musk's inflammatory, "tell us what you did last week if you want to keep your job" weekend email to millions of federal workers and a subsequent follow-up on Monday. "You can protest all you want outside the departments of this government. You can protest all you want, but the American people disagree with you," she said. "You're protecting the bureaucracy. The bureaucracy is not a business. Those are not real jobs producing federal revenue, by the way. They're consuming taxpayer dollars. Those jobs are paid for by the American tax people who work real jobs, earn real income, pay federal taxes, and then pay those federal employees. Federal employees do not deserve their jobs. Federal employees do not deserve their paychecks, and those are jobs that can be fired at will." Gleason is, of course, a federal employee, apparently in charge of firing those, yes, federal employees, who, under Green's blanket assessment, do not have real jobs. Green, whose government salary is also funded by the American taxpayers, scooped up a number of tech stocks, including for Musk's Tesla, shortly after the election. Another twist, she's the head of the subcommittee overseeing Doge. Green's office did not respond to Vanity Fair's request for comment. And about Musk, he's classified as a special government employee and draws no salary for whatever it is he does with Doge, though you just know he's not paying room and board for his EEOB crash pad. That designation, however, appears to be just as hand-wavy and because I said so as DOJ's overall mission. According to federal ethics guidelines, a special government employee is not meant to work more than 130 days in a 365-day period. Though those familiar with the calendar will note that July 4th, 2026, the deadline that Trump gave Musk and DOGE to achieve their budget-slashing goals, is beyond 130 days from Trump's executive order establishing the group. Not to mention that, yes, in the November social media statement heralding the birth of DOGE, Trump wrote that the great Elon Musk, working in conjunction with the American patriot Vivek Ramaswamy, will lead the Department of Government Efficiency, DOGE. Additionally, Trump's day one executive order officially establishing the DOGE agenda contains another deadline that is quietly passed, which would establish a DOGE team, a litter, if you will, for each federal agency. Each agency head shall establish within their respective agencies a DOGE team of at least four employees, which may include special government employees, hired or assigned within 30 days of the date of this order, it reads. Agency heads shall select the DOGE team members in consultation with the USDS administrator. Each DOGE team will typically include one DOGE team lead, one engineer, one human resources specialist, and one attorney. Agency heads shall ensure that DOGE team leads coordinate their work with USDS and advise their respective agency heads on implementing the president's DOGE agenda. There are more than 400 federal agencies. The 30 days since the EO have already passed, and the public has heard nothing of these oversight teams. It is also unclear whether these 1,600-ish specialized jobs are meant to be new hires or existing DOGE or agency employees getting a new set of hall monitor duties instead of or in addition to their current job descriptions. Perhaps Musk could sum that up in 5 bullet points for us by Monday. It should really take less than 5 minutes to write. He's already proven himself to be a master of managing up at a Wednesday White House meeting with Trump's cabinet. We will make mistakes. We won't be perfect. For example, with you said, one of the things we canceled very briefly was Ebola prevention. A White House did not respond to Vanity Fair's request for comment and clarification. And our last headline today, America's food safety is now in the hands of Don Jr.'s hunting buddy. This is by Catherine Ebon on February 24th. Late last week, amid mass purges of key personnel at the nation's health agencies, a Florida attorney with a surprisingly slim resume was named acting deputy commissioner for human foods at the Food and Drug Administration. The role, which is not subject to Senate approval, is an important one. In it, Kyle Diamantis, 37, will be responsible for ensuring the safety of roughly 80% of the nation's food supply. The already overtaxed division is vital to public health, responsible for everything from overseeing the complex manufacturing of infant formula to responding to deadly bacterial contamination and managing food supplies in the wake of hurricanes and floods. Diamantis' LinkedIn profile is a study in brevity. He received a law degree from the University of Florida in 2013. He started his next listed job as an attorney at the law firm Jones Day in Miami in 2021, ascending to partner last year. He has now archived Jones Day bio, described him as having more than 10 years of experience advising food, cosmetic, dietary supplement, drug, and other life sciences and consumer goods clients on a wide range of regulatory compliance and enforcement matters. Prior to that job, he worked as a senior associate at the Orlando office of the law firm Baker Donaldson. Diamantis' limited experience for such a major regulatory position, when compared with the experience of his predecessor, appears to have been offset by another giant significant qualification. The young attorney is a friend and hunting buddy of Donald Trump Jr., the president's firstborn son, Vanity Fair has learned. In March 2021, the two men were photographed holding dead Osceola wild turkeys and grinning. A post on X by Mike Tussey, the founder of the hunting outfit Osceola Outdoors, which also organizes hunts of alligators and hogs, described the scene as follows. Don Jr. with his good friend Kyle Diamantis, Kyle's first Osceola. A photograph of Trump Jr., Diamantis, and Tussey with a single turkey is also featured in a gallery of pictures on Osceola Outdoors website. Osceola turkeys, known for their striking plumage, were long ago on the brink of extinction due to overhunting and habitat destruction. According to the Florida Wildlife Federation, they are named after Chief Osceola of the Seminole Indian Nation. Though the FDA position appears to be Diamantis' first government job, the Osceola was not his first dead bird. In November 2015, Back County hunters and anglers posted an image of a dead duck captioned, "A Saturday Morning Redhead," shared by Kyle Diamantis here. Trump Jr.'s hunting habits have long provoked outrage. He was once photographed in Africa holding a dead elephant's tail that he had apparently severed with a knife. More recently, Italian authorities opened an investigation after it was reported that he'd killed a protected species of duck known as the ruddy shell duck. What skills Trump Jr.'s hunting buddy, Diamantis, will bring to the FDA's human foods program, where he will manage its $1 billion budget, remains to be seen. An FDA spokesperson referred Vanity Fair to an agency link that said Diamantis has extensive experience working with various federal and state agencies and policymakers, scientific organizations, consumer advocacy groups, and industry stakeholders. Reached for comment, a spokesperson for Trump Jr., Arthur Schwartz, emailed Vanity Fair that, given the presidential son's leading role in staffing up the Trump-Vance administration, are you really asking whether a member of the transition team played a role in the transition? You people are a bunch of retards. Regarding the protected duck in Italy, a spokesman previously told the Washington Post that Trump Jr. follows all hunting rules and regulations and plans on fully cooperating with any investigations. Late last week, Elon Musk's Department of Government Efficiency purged the division of an estimated 89 staff members, leading to the resignation of James Jones, the Deputy Commissioner for Human Foods. An experienced regulator, Jones has spent almost 20 years with the Environmental Protection Agency before joining the FDA in 2023. In his resignation letter, Jones called the indiscriminate mass terminations one more roadblock to achieving the secretary's stated objectives for making America healthy again. Among the employees dismissed were those with highly technical expertise in nutrition, infant formula, food safety response, and even 10 chemical safety staff hired to review potentially unsafe ingredients in our food supply. I can't believe that American consumers are going to support losing staff that protects the safety of the food that every one of us eats every day, says Susan Main, who served as the FDA's Director of Food Safety and Applied Nutrition from 2015 to 2023. Particularly horrifying, she said, are the cuts to the infant formula team, which she successfully lobbied Congress to grow from 9 to 13 people. With cuts to such a small staff, she said, the whole program could dissolve, and we would be in the biggest infant formula crisis you could ever imagine. As if a reminder was needed of the job's life and death stakes, the FDA on Friday announced a recall of listeria-tainted frozen nutritional shakes that had been sold to nursing homes, among other institutions, and had been linked to 11 deaths and 37 hospitalizations. This brings us to the end of our time here on the Vanity Fair Hour. Once again, you're listening to Sun Sounds of Arizona, and my name is Amy Smith. I'm your volunteer broadcaster for this program. Thanks so much for tuning in. Join me next week for another full hour of stories from VanityFair.com. Have a great week, everybody.